Lindsay read from the book of Leviticus a while ago, and he talked about how that when the Lord called Moses from the tabernacle and was telling him how to present the offerings, that they would bring the animal for the priest and sacrifice would be made. And it says, continuing, that the sons of Aaron, the priest shall put fire on the altar and lay the wood in order on the fire. And then the priest, Aaron's son, shall lay the parts, the head, and the fat in order on the wood that is on the fire upon the altar, but he will wash its entrails and its legs with water. The priest shall burn all on the altar as a burnt sacrifice, an offering made by fire, a sweet aroma to the Lord. If his offering is of the flocks, of the sheep, or of the goats, as a burnt sacrifice, he shall bring a male without blemish. He shall kill it on the north side of the altar before the Lord, and the priest, Aaron's son, shall sprinkle its blood all around the altar, and he shall cut it into its pieces with its head and its fat, and the priest shall lay them in order on the wood that is on the fire upon the altar, but he shall wash the entrails and the legs with water. Then the priest shall bring it all and burn it on the altar. It is a burnt sacrifice, an offering made by fire, a sweet aroma to the Lord. Verse 14. And if the burnt sacrifice of his offering to the Lord is of birds, then he shall bring his offering of turtle doves or young pigeons. The priest shall bring it to the altar, wring off its head, and burn it on the altar. Its blood shall be drained out on the side of the altar. And he shall remove its crop with its feathers and cast it beside the altar on the east side into the place of ashes. And then he shall split it at its wings, but shall not divide it completely. And the priest shall burn it on the altar on the wood that is on the fire. It is a burnt sacrifice, an offering made by fire, a sweet aroma to the Lord. The tabernacle was the tent that served as the center of worship for the nation of Israel during the wilderness wanderings, and actually for about 500 years until the day that Solomon built the tabernacle. The central idea of the tabernacle is given in the book of Exodus when God ordained the building of the tabernacle. And in Exodus chapter 25 and verse 8, the Lord tells Moses that he wants them to make him a sanctuary, and that he wanted them to make the sanctuary so that God may dwell with his people. The tabernacle was a movable tent of meeting. It's called by a number of names, that being tent of meeting. And what God wanted to do was that he wanted to dwell with his people, the Israelites. And what he wanted to do was to have fellowship with them. And this would become the spiritual center of Israel for 500 years. And that whenever they moved, that this would be the place that they would commune with God. Actually, there's about 50 chapters in the Bible that discuss the tabernacle. But every time the children of Israel stopped, the tabernacle was the center of their encampment. And then, in accordance with Numbers chapter 2, they would all place themselves at a strategic locations around the camp, and that was in accordance with the law of God. It was at the tabernacle that God communed with Moses and the people. It was a place of sacrifice. It was a place of worship. It was a place that God communed in the daytime with the cloud of smoke and at the nighttime with the cloud of fire. The tabernacle was built out of the spoils of Egypt. Actually, when they got ready to leave Egypt, God told them to take up the spoils of the Egyptians, and so they used gold and silver, bronze and precious woods and rare cloth. And it has been estimated that if the tabernacle was recreated in its original form today, it would be well over $1 million just to construct this small tabernacle. And the offerings from the Israelites paid for all of the materials. As a matter of fact, they had more and abundant than they needed. The tabernacle consisted of the court fence, about 7.5 feet tall. It had a gate. There was only one of those. And in front of the gate was a bronze altar. Behind the bronze altar, between it and the tabernacle itself, was the bronze laver that would be used for washing. And then there was the tabernacle tent, and inside of the tabernacle tent there were two parts. There was the holy place, where the golden lampstand would be kept and the lights would be burned continually. There would be the table of showbread that would be changed every day, 12 loaves for each tribe. And then there was the altar of incense that was put right before the veil that separated the holy from the most holy of place. And then when they would worship, they would actually bring the veil on the outside of the altar of incense so that the incense would go into the most holy of holies. But in the most holy of holies, which separated by the veil, was of course the Ark of the Covenant. It was on a daily ministration that the priest would go into the holy place to attend the lampstand, to change the bread, and to make the specific altar of incense and the requirements of the law. And as we know, that it was only the high priest that went into the most holy of holies once a year for the atonement of the people, and when he would make sacrifice for the people. The courtyard is where you would find the bronze altar. It was about 150 by 75 feet in circumference. The bronze altar was not huge. It was about 10 feet by 6 feet. And it was on this bronze altar that the daily sacrifices would be made, the daily burnt offerings and the meal offerings. And there was a lot of utensils that were accompanied with this, bronze pans, as the bronze shovels and the basins and the flesh hooks and all of this. And all of it was located there in the beginning, or in the entrance of the tabernacle, so that this would be the actual place that they would come in communion with the people, using all of these things. Now, the priests were the only ones that were allowed to do this service. You had to be of the tribe of Levi. Not everybody could do this. And they performed all of the ceremonies, including that of the high priest. But it is this bronze altar located in the beginning that was the only place that an Israelite could come into the holy place and come in contact with the activities and the worship of the tabernacle. And this became a key figure and a key place in the relationship of their communion with God and worshiping God. And that in this bronze altar was the sacrifice to be made. And even though the offerer was not allowed, the worshiper was not allowed to touch this bronze altar. In Numbers chapter 4 and Numbers chapter 18, they were prohibited from touching any of these things, much as you would remember Uzzah touching the Ark of the Covenant would be struck dead. It was the only tabernacle furnishing with which the Israelite had any association. It must have been an amazing thing for a person to actually enter into. The gate, of course, would be closed most of the time. But when they came to make their sacrifice, they would actually step into the holy of place and come to this altar where they would make their sacrifice. But I'm going to go back to our text of Leviticus chapter 1, and I want you to note something that you might not have particularly noticed as we read this. Because when God speaks to Moses and says, this is the way that I want you to conduct this worship, it says that when in verse 2, that when any one of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of the livestock, whether it's of the herd or of the flock. It could be a bull, it could be a goat, it could be a sheep, whatever it may be. And it says in verse 3 that if his offering is a burnt sacrifice of the herd, let him offer a male without blemish. There were qualifications about the kind of animal that was required to be used. And then it says that he shall offer it on his own free will at the door of the tabernacle of meeting before the Lord. And then the offerer, the individual, will take this animal, whether it is a bull or a goat or a sheep or whatever it is, and he will put his hand on the head of that burnt offering. But what we may not have noticed is that the man making the offering will not only put his hand on the head of the animal, and the Lord will accept the death of this animal in place to purify him, making him right with God. And so he's making the sacrifice, putting his hand on the head of this animal, God thereby recognizing that he's making a sacrifice for himself, and that God would recognize that the death of this animal was going to do that. That it was the man who slaughtered the animal. It was the man who would take the knife and cut the throat of the animal. It was the individual that would kill that animal. It was not the priest. The priest would kill the bird. If he brought a bird, that he would wring its neck. But when these two sacrifices were made, it was the man who would slaughter the young bull in the Lord's presence, and then Aaron's sons and the priest will present the animal blood by spattering it against the sides of the altar that stands at the entrance of the tabernacle. They would take and dip and spread it over the altar itself. You and I live in a homogenized, pasteurized, sanitized world. No doubt you're going to go home and have lunch today, and maybe you're going to have a steak. That steak came in a plastic container that was probably frozen that you bought at Publix. If you're going to have chicken, you probably got that in some kind of a plastic bag, and you've got that in the freezer, and maybe it's in the crock pot now cooking, I don't know. If you're going to have beef, yep, you did the same thing, went down to Publix or wherever it was, bought you one of those little round things, or bought you a pack of about a pound of sirloin or whatever it is. And folks, we get our milk out of plastic gallon jugs. We think milk comes from plastic. We live in a world that we're not experienced about all that thing. I mean, we're used to going to Zaxby's and Chick-fil-A to get our chicken and going to Texas Longhorn to get our steaks. There are a few of you I know in the audience that understand what it is to kill an animal and to gut it and to clean it and then prepare it. We don't live in that kind of society anymore. There are very, very few young people that have any concept at all about what it means to take a living animal, and sometimes a large animal like a bull or a large cow of some kind, and to take a knife. And I'm not doing this to be demonstrative. I'm just telling you this is what happens. To take a knife and slit that throat and to gut that animal and to have all of that activity. And you've done that before, and you realize that when you walk away from that, you don't wear white clothes. You don't wear your Sunday go to meeting clothes. We live in a world like that. We do not experience the blood required in killing an animal. But one of the things that we need to put in our minds and to focus on is that here is an individual in this burnt offering, Leviticus chapter 1, and when he brings this animal, whether it's of the herd or of the flock, and he puts his hand on this animal, and it probably was not a pet. They didn't have pets back then as much. I mean, they probably had a few, but they weren't like us. But you had this animal, and you put your hand, and you felt the head of that cow. You felt, and he was squirming around, and you know what's coming. You know what's about to happen. And you have a knife in your hand, and it is your requirement that you take that knife and you kill that animal. And they take that blood that comes out of that animal, and they go sprinkle it around. And that's what was required. As a matter of fact, in the next ones, in Leviticus chapter 3, when it makes the peace offering, you'll notice that the same thing is said here, that you're to do the very same thing. That in Leviticus chapter 3, he says in verse 1 that when his offering is a sacrifice of a peace offering, if he offers it of the herd, whether male or female, he shall offer it without blemish before the Lord. He shall lay his hand on the head of his offering and kill it at the door of the tabernacle of meeting, and Aaron's sons and the priest shall sprinkle the blood all around the altar. Then he shall offer from the sacrifice of the peace offering an offering made by fire to the Lord, the fat that covers the entrance and all the fat that is on the entrance, and so forth it goes. In chapter 4 and verse 4, he says that he shall bring the bull to the door of the tabernacle of the meeting before the Lord, lay his hand on the bull's head, and kill the bull before the Lord. I'm not an expert on this, but I've been told that there's about 3 gallons of blood that'll come out of one of those creatures. And that was his job. That was his responsibility. Then the priest would carry out the rest of the act that had to be done. And here's the story. When the man has finished doing that, he turns and goes home with blood all over his hands and blood probably on his clothes. And he returns home where he had to clean himself of the blood. His hands were stained with blood because he personally was guilty of the blood of the animal. He killed that animal, not the priest. He killed that animal. And he personally had to bear the shame of killing an animal because of his sin. It doesn't matter what you think about animals. It does tell us that here is an animal that in its innocence of being an animal has no idea what is about to happen, but because of your sin, because of your guilt before God, and because of the commandment of God, he requires you to take that animal and slit its throat and kill it there, and you are the ones that have that responsibility. You are personally involved with that. God made that as part of the law. I tell you, blood's one of those things you just don't get out of things. And they didn't have the kind of weird stuff we have today. And we know from forensic science that you really never kind of get rid of blood. It's still there. They may not have had those little fancy blue lights back then, but I'm going to tell you, there was blood all over the place. And I can only imagine, I just try to think about what it would be like to live in those times, and that, you know, it's time for you to go and make a sacrifice. And so, you know, you go out and you pick this animal and you know what's about to happen to him and you know who's got to do what. And so you take him, and then when you're walking back home and your wife and your family see you and you're just covered in blood. Jesus is the sacrifice for sin. Read with me in the book of Hebrews, in the 13th chapter, something that should really just send chills down our backs. It should make us pause and think and to consider. Because the language that is used in the book of Hebrews is the language that we have just shared together. We have an altar from God from which those who serve the tabernacle have no right to eat. For the bodies of those animals whose blood is brought into the sanctuary by the high priest for sin are burned outside the camp. Therefore, Jesus also, that he might sanctify the people with his own blood, suffered outside the gate. We have blood on our hands. It's easy to blame somebody else for things. I mean, Adam blamed Eve, Eve blamed the snake. We've been blaming other people for everything. It's not the person sitting next to you that's got blood on his hands. You do, and I do. We have blood. Now, it would be scriptural, I guess we could say, that, you know, well, now, wait a minute. Those Jews are the ones that, you know, they're the ones that killed Jesus. Well, that's true, and I think it's interesting the language that we find in Matthew 27 that when we have Jesus before Pilate, you remember what he says, and of course, he didn't literally have it on him, but it's interesting the language that the Pilate used here about how he tries to remove himself from the situation with Jesus when he says that he saw that he could not prevail at all, but rather that a tumult was rising. He took water and washed his hands before the multitude and said, I am innocent of the blood of this just person. You see to it. How'd that work out for you, Pilate? You could wash your hands until the day is long. You will never be innocent of the blood of Jesus Christ. You can say that you are. All guilty of the blood of Jesus Christ. And it's easy to say, well, now that's Pilate now. That's him. He's the one that did. No. We are the ones. And then later, as it goes on to say here, oh, yes, I am innocent of the person. And all the people answered and said, his blood be on us and on our children. And yes, technically, there's a line of proof to say, yes, the Jews are the ones that killed Jesus. They're the ones that put him up there. But I'm going to tell you, you and I are killed Jesus. You and I are responsible for the blood of Jesus Christ. You cannot wash the blood of Christ off your hands. We put our hands on the head of Jesus, and we killed him. I am personally responsible for the death of Jesus. I am, and so are you. We need to think about that statement, that our blood, or his blood, be on us. What we're about to do here is the Lord's Supper. There's a lot of things that we can think about, a lot of things we can dwell on, and they're all good. But there are times we need to sit there and look at our hands and realize how bloody our hands are. And I can't blame anybody else, and I'm not going to blame anybody else for why I take of this remembrance. Because Jesus said, do this in remembrance of me. Because one of the things that Jesus wants us to do, I guess if I can say it this way, Jesus says, I want you to remember who killed me. It's not him, it's not her, it's not them, it's me. And when we take of the Lord's Supper, and we take of his body, we take of the bread, and we take of the fruit of the vine, which is representative of his blood, we need to realize that that is mine. I am personally guilty of putting my head on the head of Jesus and killing him. Look at your hands and see the blood. And the reason that God's Son died on the cross was because of my sin. I am guilty of the blood of Jesus Christ.